This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you missed the beginning of today's program, you can find the podcast and all the episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. I bring that up because we heard from Les Beck about the improbable way he met a man who slept in the same barracks in the same prisoner of war camp as Les's late father. That was at Stalag 17B in Krems, Austria, and Orville Lewis of Orange Cove, California, is Les's new best friend. We've been diving into Orville's story. He told us about some of his early experiences with the 388th Bomb Group, the 563rd Squadron, flying out of Nettleshall, England. And this is in July 1943, early on in the air war in Europe, a time when the German Luftwaffe had plenty of fighter planes to send at you.
Well, in our interrogation before we'd make a flight, usually they'd say it'd be about 600 ME-109s here and heavy flak neck plates. Then we'd be 500 maybe Focke-Wulf FW-190s. There were several hundred airplanes we were going to meet on each mission we went. And the flak was terrible. That was worse than the planes. I didn't mind the planes. You could shoot back. But the flak, you could not do anything about it. It'd just black out. But I was very fortunate. I only had one hole knocked within the side of my shoulder in my turret. And that's the closest flak ever came to hitting me. But that's close enough. It knocked a hole in that plane.
Well, now it's starting to make sense. You know, I'm thinking here that you beat ridiculous odds just to meet the son of someone who was in your prison camp, but hearing how many airplanes were fighting against you and how much ground fire there was, you beat some pretty good odds to survive those missions. But I'm sure in the midst of it, you were aware of other planes and other crews who didn't survive?
Oh, definitely so. I saw some of them didn't look so good. Really, it just exploded in the air. I guess the oxygen or something blew up and just pieces of it flying in the air, and then you could see a plane going down and the fighters circling it, be six or eight fighters around it. It kind of wore on your nerves a little bit, but at least you could see those fighters coming in and you could shoot at them, but you couldn't shoot at the flak.
Well, you can say it get on your nerves a little bit. I'm trying to understand how it doesn't scare you to death.
I guess it did, but you know, what got me worse than anything, I had twin 50s, and one of them I'd fire one round, and it lock up. I only had one working, but the German fighter didn't know that. I had one guy coming straight down at me, and I turned the turret up at him, and he veered off. He thought I had twins, I guess. Just wasn't good. And the day we got shot down, I had both of them working perfect because I found the trouble myself. There was a screw in the belt pawl feed that would come down the first round, and it locked up, and it would not fire. Now, I had that working perfect, but I didn't get to use it at all that day.
Well, I want to hear all about that mission, but I guess it would be interesting, too, to discuss your fourth mission, because this is the same mission on which Les's father was shot down. July 26, 43, Hanover was the target. And that sounds like that was a pretty eventful mission for all the B-17s in the air.
It was. I know we lost a lot of planes that day. I don't remember the exact number, but we lost real heavy that day. We was attacked from the time we hit across the English Channel until we got back. Even our plane happened to get attacked as we got back to the Channel that day. Well, there's Miss Smith 210s, the fighter bombers. There's three or four of them. I think there was four. Just getting to the White Cliffs of Dover there, here they came. Right, we was by ourselves. But we put one of them down in smoke. I don't know whether he went on down or not, but I had my flight suit halfway down around my feet, and I couldn't get around in time. I told the pilot and co-pilot I got caught with my pants down that time.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. But we drove them off anyway.
Well, you say that like that's not a big deal, but I want people to understand, first of all, you've survived fighters all the way to the target, all the way from your base in England, all the way into Germany, Hanover, fighters all the way, flak over the target. You're on the way home. You're almost home. And how many German planes are coming for just your plane?
I'm pretty sure there's just four of them.
Only four. Oh, that's four against one. That's not a bad odds or anything. So, and you're on the top turret?
Correct. And I asked the pilot to lower his left wing, which he did. And it looked like my tracer was going into that plane, but he kept flying. But he left us alone. After that.
How do you keep your wits about you in that situation? Because you're outnumbered. They've got more firepower than you do. Their planes are faster than yours. How do you keep functioning and do what you have to do?
I don't know. You just automatically trained to do it, I guess, because you know you have to do it. One plane that day, an FW-190, that was Gehring Circus, we called him. He came down. I was after a plane in front of me, and I looked up at an angle. Here come one. I ducked my head. His prop was that close. My turret was too slow to get on him. The time I got on him, he was flying through the formation. I couldn't shoot at him because it would hit my own plane. But I actually, his prop was within inches of my head. But my turret was too slow to get around on him. You just automatically, you fight. You just do what you have to do. I'll tell you this much. Every flight I made, I'll never make another flight. But you know, the next morning we'd be out there running around, ready to go again next morning.
So you get home from them, oh, I don't ever want to do that again, but you're right back at it. And I'm glad you said that, because as I look at the dates of all the missions that you flew, you guys really were flying almost every day. How exhausting was that?
It was very exhausting. And I tell you, if it lasted, I don't know of anyone that made those 25 missions back in those days. They told me if you make three of them, you're very fortunate. And I'll tell you, it was rough.
Well, and you were in so early, maybe they didn't tell you this, but I've had guys tell me that when they went to aerial gunnery school, as you did, that a lot of times an instructor would get their attention by giving them the average life expectancy of a gunner in aerial combat?
Yes, I was told that through gunnery school.
What did they quantify it as?
Oh, I think it was in the seconds. It sure wasn't in the minutes. In actual combat, it was in seconds.
That gets your attention a little bit. So that Hanover mission was your fourth. You had a fifth mission where your pilot had to abort. And, well, I want to ask you about the sixth mission, because that was foreshadowing, it sounds like, a little bit too. But first, tell me about your pilot and this crew. Were you guys a pretty tight-knit crew?
I would say there was only one guy that gave us any trouble. We liked him. I ran around with him, but he was from the Bronx in New York. And we were Oklahoma and Texas and Nebraska, and we didn't get along too well with the New York guys. And this guy won two taxis, and those guys were very outspoken and say things they shouldn't. But otherwise, we were real close. The pilot, when I redlined the plane, only one time he ever went over my head and flew it. But he was very fortunate nothing happened. But he always respected me, and the co-pilot had been a mechanic. And he said, if you ever mess up, said, I'll know it.
Specifically with him, with your pilot, Pickard, what did you appreciate about his performance under fire? Because it sounds like you guys were under fire virtually any time you were in the air.
He was very, very good. Very good pilot. He couldn't ask for a better one. He was younger than I was, just a kid. But he could fly that airplane, and he told us, we don't want to be dead heroes. We want to be live cowards. We have to be. He said, if I say bail out, bail out. But he never did do that until we really needed to bail out. He was a nice kid. In fact, every time we get in rough weather, he'd say, well, it's about time Lewis took over. And then he told me, I ran into him at Le Havre before we came home from overseas. Le Havre had a tent city there. He told me that I had the most natural talents he ever saw, and anyone flying a plane and wanted me to stay in flying, but I didn't. When I got back, I flew a Piper Cub, and that's it.
But you mentioned earlier, you actually had some stick time in B-17s. What did that feel like?
Felt real good. I enjoyed it. Felt natural. I'd watched the pilot so much, it didn't bother me at all.
Well, let's talk about your seventh and final mission. Castle, Germany is the target, July 30th, 1943. And I imagine July 30th is a day you've never forgotten. It certainly changed your life, didn't it?
It was the day I was inducted into the service and the day I was shot down, 1 year to the day.
Makes it a pretty special day every year for you, I guess. So take us start to finish from that day. It must have been a pretty long day for you, but remember for us what you can.
As we got out over the English Channel, I test-fired my gun. They were perfect. And we hadn't much more than got. We were over Belgium, which is not very far inland, whenever the sky just blacked out in front of us. It was flak. We were flying 21,000. And as far as I know, we were tailing Charlie. We'd had the trouble getting the plane right. Something went wrong, and we were tailing Charlie, and the planes kept aborting. First time we'd ever got 500 bombers in the air, but they were aborting so fast that we just kept pulling up, and we got way up into the formation. Just as we settled down, we were hit. We got a direct hit through number 3 gas tank. and that fuel poured all over the plane, and the metal was spewing all over us, and there were fighters coming in. Well, I put my chute on and crawling back up my turret to get a shot at them. Co-pilot pulled me down, said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Get out of here." Well, metal was spewing all over us. And the radio man and I were supposed to go out to Bombay. Well, I saw the Bombay doors, and then I give a hard tug, and the bomb dropped. And the flames were coming up and just lapping up, and I timed it in between those flames and jumped out. Radio man, I talked to him later, said he opened the door. He just slammed it back, said all he could see was fire in there. So he went back, jumped out the rear, the left-hand side of the fuselage. At that time, they had where the door gunners were. He went out that side. So I timed myself, looked at my little chute. It was an English, well, it's an emergency chute, 22-foot, and you hit the ground hard with them. Well, I checked to see it wasn't on fire, and I laid there, and the wind whistled around the airplane going on away. Finally, I decided I'll pull a ripcord because I couldn't up there at 21,000 because of no oxygen. I was breathing real hard, and so finally I couldn't find it. And I knew it had to be there. I thought, well, that isn't there. I got to rip this thing apart. Well, I found it finally, and I jerked it, and I was laying flat on my back, and in my head and heels felt like they touched, and it hurt me pretty bad because the chute didn't fit me. The first time I was in the service, I had the chute adjusted, and they gave me the wrong harness back. And I never put it on when I left, and I should have. But anyway, I was going down, fighter planes come in, and I thought, well, I was on target for them. But the German came through, and he gave me a prop wash, and it folded my chute up. I tried to straighten it out, and I made it worse. So I made up my mind that from now on I'll just leave it alone. And then the other plane went by, and I waved at those German pilots. I waved back at him. Shoot me, go ahead.
You mean he waved with his hands or he tipped his wings? He waved with his hands at you. He was that close.
He acted that close, he waved with his hand. And then one of the guys, I could see him floating down the chute out there. I yelled at him and waved at him. He never did answer me or wave back. Anyway, I hit the ground in what was the name of that little town in Belgium? I forget. Oh, Antwerp. It wasn't too little. Yeah. I landed in the gutter of a street there. The guy with a double-barreled shotgun, a Belgian, he pointed that gun at him to help. He captured me, you know, but he helped me roll my chute up, and here come the Germans on motorbikes. Two of them. I couldn't run. I couldn't do anything. My back was hurting me. And so they come up and stuck a little gun in my stomach and hands up. So I put my hands up. They searched me, and Gestapo came along in the car. I had a chauffeur, and he's riding in the back, threw me in the car with him. And he gave me a hard time. I said, well, we didn't start the war. You guys started it. I shouldn't have said that. He blew his lid, boy, and I thought, sure, he's going to shoot me. Said, my home was in Cologne. Said, his family was all killed. The bombers did it. Because Cologne was where they had a ball bearing factory, and we'd hit it pretty hard. And his family was killed. They took us out to headquarters and took me in and interrogated me, wanted to know where we were going, how I was flying, all that. And I'd give them a name, rank, and cell number, and that was it. I wouldn't give them any more.
Was it just you, or were some of your crewmates captured at the same time?
I was by myself. They put me in a St. Giles prison. I don't know whether you'd ever heard of it or not, but they went out there, and the door about 12 feet tall and 18 inches thick with a lock on it, monster lock. The walls were cemented out. You could see skylights way up high. And threw me in a cell back there. It had a little pot in there for you to drink water out of, and nothing that they ever fed you.
And little did Orville Lewis know, it would be more than 600 days before he would taste freedom again. We're out of time on this episode, but next time on Hometown Heroes, we'll learn about this 95-year-old's nearly 2 years as a prisoner of war. The highs, the lows, the close calls. Go to hometownheroesradio.com for photos and more information. Thanks again to Les Beck for letting me know about his jaw-dropping encounter with Orville at the Fresno VA. And thank you for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.